Ms. Kitty will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The workers' comp statute was intended to provide an exclusive system governing compensation to employees who are injured at work. It's a statutory scheme that was set in lieu of common law liability based on negligence. And this was a give and take sort of situation. The employee that's injured receives prompt, fair, adequate compensation without proving a thing, doesn't have to prove fault. In exchange, he's barred from suing his employer. On the other side, the employer cannot get sued. And in exchange for that benefit, his sacrifice is that he can't put forth the common law defenses and he has to pay workers' comp regardless of fault. Workers' compensation statute is not an arbitrarily abolishing the employee's common law claim. It's a substitute of a prompt, certain amount, adequate and fair remedy, legal remedy, as opposed to common law remedy.
Well, if it's a statutory scheme and the statute describes and defines general contractors and so forth, why wouldn't they have said owner as well as general contractor?
Okay. Well, and that's what this case is about, whether the owner can be a general contractor. It specifically does not exclude owner. And why it didn't include it, I'm not sure. But if you look at the definition of
But by that rationale, you can pick anybody that you want. Say, well, they weren't excluded, so that means we can pick anybody else to say that they were intended to be included as well.
You could pick anybody who fits the definition that's provided by the statute of a general contractor. And that definition is a person who undertakes to procure the performance of work or service, either separately or through the use of a subcontractor.
Of course, this term's been around longer than the labor code.
That's right. Yes, sir.
I mean, general contractor's been around, hundreds of years? And it usually doesn't mean owner. I mean, that's why the term came into, you had the owner, the general, and the sub.
Gotcha.
And that's... So you're asking us to, and it is a defined term, but you're asking us to say it means something it hadn't meant for 100 years.
And the reason I'm asking you to do that, and you could see in the definition, several different terms have been used over the years. Prompt contractor, principal contractor, the other original contractor. But the reason why a premise owner should be included is it promotes the policy behind the workers' comp. Workers' compensation statute is a guarantee of prompt payment. You're ensuring that an injured worker on your premises gets paid promptly and adequately without showing fault. And having the premise owner who provides this benefit to the employee promotes the policy behind the workers' comp. And not including them in the protection of 406.123, the employee receives all the benefit at no cost whatsoever, and the employer, in this case Entergy, provides the benefit without any protection.
Will this shift, obviously, your premiums depend on how dangerous how many workers they think you're going to have injured.
Correct.
And let's take a homeowner. Homeowner doesn't have any employees except the kid down the block that mows the yard. So let's say they, that kind of person, their premiums wouldn't be high. But if they would treat them as a general contractor to build an addition on the house, maybe their premiums ought to be higher. Is this going to be a way to get around paying the right premiums so that in the end the state has to pick it up through the carrier goes into receivership?
In the situation that you're presenting, and in this situation, if you are, let's say, a property owner, and you decide to provide workers' compensation to a contractor who's going to add to your house, you're going to have to submit these contractors, how many, et cetera, to an insurance carrier who's going to set your premium at a certain amount of rate.
So that's what occurred here.
Correct.
that the premium paid by Entergy was equivalent as if it had been a general contractor.
Correct. We say these are the people that will be working on our plant, and our premiums are set at that rate. If I have a contractor come in and I'm going to supply the workers' comp, then we have to submit everything as if it's our employees. These are the people working, and they set the premiums at the party.
So you think the legislature just sort of missed this relationship?
I don't know if they missed it or they intended it, because we do fit the general contractor definition, or if they didn't think about, well, it may not apply to a premise owner. I am not sure what was the purpose, but I do know that including the premise owner does promote what the workers' comp statute is out to, what is there for. In fact, look at some of the recent cases, and I thought
Before you go to your recent cases, let me ask this. I noticed, I don't recall either you or the other party referencing the legislative history on this section. Has anyone looked at the legislative history to see if there is any intent, if there might be, should the history reflect the intent, if is there any history?
I have looked at the history, and I saw it. Nothing talked about the premise owner at all.
Well, there's or about the intent of this section.
The only thing, and I think plaintiff's counsel brings it out, or in this case responded, that the old statute, the old version of the statute, in the definition of subcontractor, it had said that a subcontractor is one who contracts with someone who contracts with another party. But that language has been taken out, and the new language is the one that's in force and effect for my case. But some of the recent cases, let's say you have a premise owner, party A, who contracts with party B, who contracts with party C, who contracts with party D. With the recent cases, C is the one that provided the workers' comp. And they have been declared both a general contractor and a subcontractor. And the reason they were declared a general contractor, and back to the original definitions of general contractor, the prime or original contractor, well, this is party number C, and or letter C, and they are considered a general contractor. And why? Because they fit the definition in the statute, which is they hire somebody to do part or all their work. They are also considered a subcontractor. Why? Because they were hired to do part of all of somebody's work. So in that situation, party C is both a general and a sub.
If that were the case in your situation, you would then, your position would be that you could buy a comp and you would be the statutory employer of employees of A, B, C, D, and E, whoever you bought the comp for.
Whoever I bought the comp for, yes, sir.
All the way down.
Yes, sir. And that's the ED case or ETI case where you had somebody buying it for two down, and the case said you can have multiple employers, and they're all your employees, so you can't sue each other. And yes, everybody was covered by that one insurance, workers' compensation insurance, and therefore the person who has the workers' compensation insurance is the employer and therefore protected. And it all goes to why we have workers' compensation in the first place. It's so that these employees, hey, they get this prompt, fair, adequate compensation for being injured without showing any fault at all. I mean, they don't prove a thing.
A lot of it depends, doesn't it, on just the reality of the situation. I mean, I might build a house and go hire a general contractor to direct the work, to supervise the work and all that, but I might decide to be my own general contractor in building my home. And I can see how they wouldn't necessarily be mutually exclusive. And what happened here? Did Entergy act as its own general contractor in this case as a factual matter?
In fact, and good point, as it's page 117 of the record is Jim Morrissey's deposition. He describes what this work was. Entergy was doing work at the plant and supplemented its workforce with IMC employees. They were hired to do a specific part of the job, turbine and generator work. And they were supplementing our workforce, and that's a good point.
But even if you didn't do any work at all, under your concept of the way this works, even if you had someone in the office who never went out and did any work, and you hired 13 contractors to do all of your work, you're still the statutory employer.
I believe we are. I believe we fit the definition. But even if you don't, even if you don't see it that way, I think a premise owner is not precluded from being a general contractor. I think if we take it on the work ourselves and we hire somebody to supplement our workforce, then we are acting as a general contractor. If you look at the plain language of the statute, you hire somebody to do some work, you're a general contractor, then we would fit even if I don't take on that work.
But we don't need to go there in this case. Right?
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, one of the purposes of the COP statute is to have the person who's directing the work make sure that the work site is safe and have an interest in making that happen. And so we don't need to stretch it as far as you're asking us to still promote that purpose.
Correct. Correct. In this particular case, we did take on the work. We hired IMC to supplement our workforce. Therefore, we were acting as a general contractor in this particular case.
Ms. Kibbe, I'm trying to get a handle on what the contract was, because there are several documents that were signed. And then the briefing, you and your opposing counsel cite different provisions that seem to contradict in the contracts. I'm trying to get a handle on what the contract was and what it says.
Okay.
Now, we know under the labor code there has to be a written agreement,
right,
for your position to hold.
Right.
That is, for your client to be the employer and to take the benefit of the workers' comp protections.
And I'll go through them if you'd like. Okay,
well, in particular, comment on respondents pointing to Section 10.2 of an agreement that says the sub shall be solely responsible for payment of the contractor's wages and solely responsible for workers' comp. That seems to directly contradict the agreement that on that point,
okay,
as you cited.
I will do that. The first contract that Entergy and IMC entered into is called General Operations Agreement. This is an agreement that applies throughout our system. We go through several states, several different operating companies.
That's what you call the system-wide contract?
It's called General Operations Agreement or the system-wide contract. And in the record, it starts on 86 or 138. In that contract, ESI, Entergy Services, Inc., is our agent, and it says it at the beginning. They're acting as an agent of all the operating companies, and it lists Entergy Gulf States. The section you're talking about, that you're talking about 10.2, Section 10, talks about independent contractors. Section 10.1 says, nothing in this article shall be construed as precluding the owners, Entergy, from raising a statutory employee defense, if applicable, to any suit filed against the owners of employee in the contract. When this was entered into, we didn't have an OPIP program. Page 84, after that was August of 97. In September of 97, we enter into another contract agreement where we have an addendum to this operations agreement. It says ESI, who's acting on behalf of themselves and the operating companies, and the contractor, IMC, mutually agree that it is their intention to recognize us as the principal employer, the statutory employer of the contractor employees. Okay, that's step two. That's our general contract over all this work. The work that the plaintiff was doing is under that umbrella and subject to the blanket contract order, which is on the record on page 78. That was entered into July of 2000. This accident happened in April of 2001. This is for work being performed at Sabine Plant. That's our plant in Bridge City that Entergy Gulf States owns and operates. It's in accordance with the general contract. And it says the compensation's in accordance with the mutually agreed OPIP wage rate. OPIP is our owner-provided insurance program. It is an industry term, OPIP, where we provide the workers' comp for the reduction in exchange for the reduction in the cost of, you know, the contract. So we're going to provide this, and its effective date is August 2000, August 2001, so it covers this accident. Well, because it is not all written out and explained how this is all going to work. In the contract, it says OPIP. We know what OPIP is. IMC knows what OPIP is. I have also included the affidavit of John Amy, who explains the situation. And in that it says, in July, which is the time of this blanket contract, we agree to provide workers' comp insurance. They agree to reduce their price in the contract. And we, as Reliance of that agreement, go out, we buy the policy, we pay the premiums, and IMC, in agreement, reduces its costs. And in Reliance of the same agreement, this blanket contract, Summers himself applied for and accepted the workers' comp benefit.
Whose affidavit explains all that, you said?
Amy's, A-Y-M-E. It's on the record 121.
Now, explain the apparently contradictory Section 10-2, which says not Entergy Gulf States, but the subcontractor, IMC, shall be solely responsible for workers' comp.
That was the original contract under independent contractors. This contract blanket order is the one where we install and steeled our OPIP program.
So it's superseded?
Yes, it is. That is the one that governs the work at Sabine Plant.
Now, there's another issue with what's the contract and who the contracting party is. The petitioner says that Entergy Services, Inc., which signed all the contracts that are relevant here and the addenda that are relevant here, according to petitioner, is not the same as Entergy Gulf States. So Entergy Gulf States didn't sign the agreement required in the statute for your position to hold. What's your response to that? Petitioner says there's at least a fact question that deserves to be tried on that.
And as you're answering your question, note that your time has expired.
Okay.
Answer the question, okay. But just do it succinctly.
Sure. The general contract the general operations contract or the system-wide contract that explains in the very first section that ESI is an agent of all these operating companies, including Entergy Gulf States, Inc., is operating on their behalf and on behalf of itself, and the blanket contract that governs this work refers back to that contract.
So that's section 1.6 of the system-wide contract?
Right, the very first paragraph, and it refers to 1.6.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Please the court, Mr. Bartley will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court. First, I would like to thank the court and opposing counsel for graciously agreeing to reschedule this argument from its September setting until today, and I do sincerely appreciate that. I see that there are three issues presented in this appeal. First, was there a contract between Entergy Gulf States Incorporated, the appellant, and my client's employer, International Maintenance Corporation? Second, did that contract meet the requirements of Article 406.123 of the Labor Code? And finally, does 406.123 apply to premises owners? And what I would show the court is this. First, can you look at any of the documents that have been presented by any of the parties and find a contract between EGS, Entergy Gulf States, and International Maintenance Corporation? You will not find one. You will find a contract governing the work.
But you're benefiting from a purported contract, aren't you? I mean, you're collecting workers' comp benefits under a contract that you say doesn't allow those benefits?
My client is collecting workers' compensation benefits because International Maintenance Corporation was covered by workers' compensation insurance. That's correct.
Through Entergy.
Well, Entergy may have paid for it. I'm not sure which Entergy company paid for it, and I'm not sure why they paid for it. It may be that Entergy got better rates. But Entergy is a large company. They have in-house counsel. They have counsel in New Orleans, Jackson, Mississippi, Beaumont, Texas. And if they had chosen to read and apply 406.123, they would have known that the Texas legislature set out certain specific requirements for a general contractor to come under the protection of that statute. assuming, and I will not because I want to talk about that later, that the energy companies could be a general contractor, they are still required to follow the provisions of Article 406.123 of the Labor Code in order to come under its protections. This goes back, and I've been practicing longer than I care to admit, to the old days when I was a young lawyer and talking about the application of indemnity agreements between general contractors and subcontractors. And we fought a number of cases in those days as to whether a company might be protected by an indemnity agreement until the Supreme Court came down and said, if you're going to have a valid indemnity agreement, that it must clearly state on its face that you are protecting a company even against the consequences of its employees' own negligence. In this case, first question is, has Entergy complied with the statute? And if you look at 406.123, it says they have to have a written agreement by which the general contractor agrees to provide workers' compensation insurance. That agreement has to be filed with the workers' compensation insurance carrier not later than the 10th day after the date on which the contract is executed. The statute sets forth what a general contractor must do to come under the protection of the statute. If you look at the ETI or ETI case that this honorable court refused writ upon, you will see that there was a contract that met those requirements. It was clear. The contract was between...
Did you argue the lack of a contract in the trial court?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Can you point to the record and show me where that is?
Not at this instant, I cannot, Your Honor.
In ET, we denied the petition, not refused the writ.
Right. I'm sorry, you're correct, Your Honor. I told you I went back a long way. But I haven't been up here for a while. But in ETI, there was a contract that clearly met the provisions of the statute. Here there is not. And remember, this is a summary judgment case. This is not a case that has been tried, that we have jury issues. This is a summary judgment case. The second question, and I have talked about that, is whether the agreement complies with 406.123 as a matter of law.
The reason you say it's not an agreement between them is because they argue that it was signed, each of them had agents sign it for them.
That's not
good enough?
It's just not clearly there, Your Honor. I mean, if you look, there are a number of contracts and agreements between the energy companies.
You're not saying companies can't have agents sign something on their behalf?
No, of course not. But I am saying there should be a contract that clearly on its face sets forth the agreement by the general contractor to provide workers' compensation insurance. And if you look at this case, this court's decision in Universal Health Services versus Renaissance Women's Group, written by Justice Owen, she talks about contractual interpretation and that basically you're not going to imply terms in a contract, or very rarely would you imply terms in a contract. Now, here we have Entergy contending that the term OCIP wage rates and price list talks about workers' compensation, but you won't find that term discussed in the contract. I don't know what OPIP means. That's something that Entergy knows. They may take the position that includes workers' compensation, but if Entergy were suing on a contract, they would have to prove up what OPIP means. That's a fact issue. And if you have a fact issue, I would submit that contract does not meet the requirements of 406.123.
Let's talk a little bit more about the agency concept. Ms. Kibbe pointed to Section 1.6 of the system-wide contract that says Entergy Services, Inc., which signed these contracts.
Correct.
As you repeatedly point out in your brief.
Yes, sir.
That provision, 1.6, says that Entergy Services, Inc. is acting, quote, for itself and as agent for each of the other Entergy companies And Entergy Companies is defined to include Entergy Gulf States, who Ms. Kibbe represents in front of this court. Why doesn't that provision provide that wherever Entergy Services, Inc. signed, it was signing on behalf of Entergy Gulf as an agent, and therefore provide the contract required under 406.123?
It may, but does the contract that it signed meet the requirements of 406.123, and did Entergy Services comply with the requirements of the statute by filing the contract or filing the contract with its insurance company, and by clearly setting out in writing in the contract that it would provide workers' compensation benefits for its subcontractors?
You've asked the question. How specifically do you think the contract did not comply with 0.123?
Well, I think if you look at EJ, it talks about a general contractor supply workers' compensation policy. It says that the workers' if I remember correctly, that the general contractor would supply workers' compensation insurance for its subcontractors. For one thing, it mentioned the word workers' compensation insurance. You don't see that in the contract between Entergy Services and International Maintenance Corporation. It says OPIP, but it doesn't say anything about workers' compensation insurance. So you come to the point.
What other specifics do you claim were not complied with in this agreement?
Well, if you look at 406.123 subsection F, it says a general contractor shall file a copy of an agreement entered to under this section with the general contractor's workers' compensation insurance carrier.
But that doesn't, if you don't do that, G says that the contract's not void.
It doesn't, but it just goes to show again that Entergy was not complying with the provisions of the contract.
There's material breaches and there's breaches.
Yes, sir.
And it has to be a material breach. If it's just a technical breach, we're going to ignore it. And this seems to say that if you don't file it with your carrier, which addresses the problem about underpaying premiums, it's an administrative violation. But that wouldn't seem to take you out of 123, would it?
No,
I mean, why would they call it an administrative? And if it doesn't take you out of 123, what does it matter if you violate it?
I think it's just something that shows that, again, that Entergy did not comply with the provisions of the statute. You still get down to, there's nothing in writing between Entergy and IMC, any of the Entergy companies and IMC, that says that Entergy will provide workers' compensation insurance for IMC, for its subcontractor on this job. It just doesn't say it. And I think that's what's required to come under the protection of 406.123.
Let's assume that the legislature intentionally excluded premise owner from the definition of general contractor, did it for a reason. What would that reason be?
Well, you have a number of different protections for the premises owners that have been enacted by the Texas legislature. Premises owners have always been treated differently than general contractors. The original statute leading to 406.123 was enacted in 1917, and that was, I believe, Civil Statute 8307, Section 6. And the language has not changed substantially since 1917. So the legislature has always looked differently at a premises owner acting as a premises owner and a general contractor.
Well, and acting as. I mean, a premises owner can act as a general contractor as well, can't they?
I believe so, Your Honor. But there has been no proof. This is a summary judgment case. There's been no proof in this case, no finding of fact, that Entergy Gulf States Incorporated acted as a general contractor from the perspective of agreeing to carry out work, doing the work itself, then subcontracting out part of the work.
If that were proved conclusively, then you would agree 123 applies?
That would be for this court to decide because, again, the legislature has always treated the premises owner differently than they have a traditional general contractor. If you look at the case law since 1917, there have been no cases where a premises owner has been protected by 406.123. It's just not there. Even in the ET case, the liability of the premises owner was not determined. That was strictly because between the general contractor, Lawson McLean, and the plaintiff.
Well, you looking at just the plain statutory definition of GC in the labor code, a house energy not one who undertook to procure IMC's work. How do they fall outside that definition?
If you look at the definition, general contractor means a person who undertakes to procure the performance of work or a service. And then you read that in combination with the definition of subcontractor that says a person who contracts with a general contractor to perform all or part of the work or services that the general contractor has undertaken to perform. That means to me that the
general... What does undertaken mean?
It means you're going to actually do the work. If you look at statutory interpretation, you give a phrase its common, normal meaning. And since 1917, when the legislature enacted Article 8307, general contractor has never been used synonymously with the term premises owner.
We have a statute here. So why does the common law definition of general contractor matter?
Well, because the statute says a person who undertakes to procure the performance of work or service, which if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, if you look at some of the other sources, says basically that's a person who goes out to do the work.
What's the purpose of this? What's the purpose of this section anyway?
Well, the purpose, I believe, if you look at 19... This goes back to 1917. This is not a new statute. I think the purpose was exactly what it said. If I had to wager an opinion, it would be to make sure that people were protected by workers' compensation if they worked for subcontractors and the general contractor wanted to carry their... wanted to make sure they were covered and to protect the general contractor.
Sometimes subs could drop their comp and not pay for it, and their employees might not be covered at that point.
I think that's probably true.
And then in general, or whoever is upstream, whoever has the right of contracting, could assure that under this statute, and this statute actually would give them some incentive to ensure that the comp coverage wouldn't.
The incentive to the general contractor is to protect the general contractor against lawsuits by employees of subcontractors. I don't know that it is that altruistic on the part of general contractors. It may also be that a general contractor can obtain cheaper rates and therefore get lower prices for subcontractors by covering the subcontractors under its policy. You know, we don't know that in this case. We don't know why Entergy chose to do this. I think that Entergy would tell you, if Entergy has told you, it's to ensure that people are...
But we look at the legislature's intent when we talk about interpreting this, not Entergy. So if the legislature, I'm just wondering, again, going back to the legislative history, there's no discussion of this at all in the bill and the committee?
I did not find it, Your Honor, but then I will acknowledge that I was not able to locate the legislative intent from 1917, which is what this statute goes back to. This goes back to, again, it's Article 8307 that was initially enacted in 1917.
I want to go back to the question that Justice O'Neill raised on this election of remedies and work on this workers' comp issue. I either missed it or it's been glossed over here. There's an amicus that indicates that Summers has elected to pursue workers' comp remedies. He's been paying workers' comp benefits by, from what I understand, this entity. Is that correct or is that not correct?
No, the workers' comp benefits were paid on behalf of IMC's insurer.
Who paid those benefits?
My understanding is that Entergy may have paid those premiums in exchange for a reduction of cost by IMC, but I don't know that that's true for certain, and it's certainly not established as a matter of law in the record. But even
and he's
then,
still receiving benefits?
I think he's now Social Security disability, Your Honor.
Well, I'm just confused here. It seems like he wants it both ways. He wants to be able to collect the benefits and pursue this this action? And
no, it's really not, because the comptroller is entitled to a subrogation interest out of any money that
sure.
Mr. Summers may collect against Energy if, in fact, that goes to trial. I mean, the law has never prevented an employee from going against a general of a sub from going against the general contractor if the general contractor's negligence was a cause of the employee's damages. But in this case, the legislature says, okay, general contractor, we're going to give you an out. We're going to say, if you comply with the meaning of the statute or with the terms of the statute, you know, it's not only that you pay for the comp, but it's also that you have to comply with the terms of the statute. That's why the statute is there, and we cannot assume that the legislature did a meaningless act.
Can a homeowner be a GC if all they do is hire subs and never really pick up a hammer themselves?
I wouldn't think so. That's not what the law and the statutes have said. I mean, if you give general contractor the meaning of the term, the meaning that Entergy would like to give it, then a homeowner could be considered a general contractor.
Well, let me ask you that. If the facts in this case were showed conclusively, and I know you said they don't,
sure.
But if they conclusively showed that Entergy acted as a general contractor, in fact, on this job, then is there a policy reason why, if they're an owner as well, you would exclude them from the benefit of the statute?
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is that they didn't comply with the statute 406.123. The second is that the legislature has always treated...
I know that, but I'm asking you, would there be... I know they've always treated them differently, but if they acted as a general contractor, in fact, is there a policy reason why, if they're an owner as well, they would be deprived of the benefit of the statute?
Well, that's really for this court to decide, but I would think that there would be, and for one of those is that the general contractor has, I'm sorry, the premises owner has protections that the general contractor does not, such as Chapter 95 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code that sets out specific limitations on liabilities of a premises owner that apply only to a premises owner. They don't apply to a general contractor. Now, what you would argue is whether a premises owner could have both the protections that's given by the legislature as a premises owner and the protection that it's given by Article 406.123. And I don't think anywhere in the case law or in the statutes is that presumed. In summation, and again, this is a summary judgment case, I would like to briefly read from the Beaumont Court of Opinions decision. Entergy did not establish it had undertaken to perform worker services and that subcontracted part of that work to IMC as a general contractor would have done. A fact issue is presented. At the very least, this case would be remanded to the court for trial on the merits. We would submit that Entergy, that two things, the contract didn't meet the requirements of the statute, and that even if it did, Entergy as the premises owner is not protected by the statute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Ms. Kibbe, where can you pinpoint in the record the written agreement that shows Entergy committed to pay workers' comp insurance?
The written agreement, that is section, I think, let me see the page. It's this record 78, that's the blanket contract that references the OPIP and John Amy's affidavit on record 121. And there is on the record that Entergy Gulf States Inc. paid the premiums. That's in John Amy's affidavit. It says EGSI. EGSI is Entergy Gulf States Inc. It's defined up top. Has paid and continues to pay the premium on the described insurance. And that is submission in court. If you look at the Williams versus Brown and Root case cited by both of us, they use the affidavit of Eastman and Brown and Root and Tracer that Tracer provided the insurance. They said because it was uncontradicted, and if you look at the trial court's Plaintiff's response to my motion for summary judgment at the trial court, not anywhere do they question the contract, not anywhere do they question that Entergy Gulf States, Inc. paid the insurance premiums. They even say that Entergy, and they define it as Entergy Gulf States, Inc., paid the premiums.
So you would say that argument is waived because it wasn't argued in the trial court?
Yes, sir. I would say it is waived. Also, with regard to the agency, 1.6, I just wanted to make it clear, defines Entergy entities, which is the first paragraph. Entergy Services, Inc. is acting on behalf of itself and the Entergy entities as defined by Section 1.6, and then it lists it in 1.6, just to explain how that works. In this case, there is no doubt with the intentions of the party. In every contract agreement we have, we state that Entergy entities are the statutory employer of our contractors where we provide this insurance. We provide the insurance. Oh, the failure to file the contract with the workers' comp, as you had stated, is an administrative violation. If you look at Patterson versus Mobile, it does not change the status. And the reason it doesn't change the status is the purpose behind the workers' comp statute. The purpose is to ensure that injured people get paid. If we're not an employer, of course we're going to want our workers' compensation payment. We're paying them, and we believe we have the protection of the workers' comp policy. That's why we have the policy out here. It's so that we ensure they get payment, adequate, fair payment, promptly, without showing proof at trial. In exchange for that, I lose all my common law rights of defenses, which I would have asserted if I had that right. No, I lost that right.
Mr. Bartley says you lose because the magic words workers' comp insurance do not appear anywhere on the contract, but rather some word or some acronym that you say is known throughout the industry.
Right. It's called OPIP. Some people call it OSIP, Owner Provided Insurance Program, and that's why I included in the record John Amy's affidavit that tells you and explains we provided the workers' comp, we paid the premiums, he accepted all the benefits. And that is based on this agreement. And all the parties assented to this agreement. Every party has relied on it. IMC has relied on it. Entergy has relied on it. And Mr. Summers relied on it. The purpose of the workers' comp is promoted by this particular situation. Here we are, Entergy. We take on this work. We supplement our workforce by hiring IMC. We provide their employees with workers' comp benefits. We there, in turn, because of 406.123, should be protected since we lose our common law rights for our defenses. Do you have any other questions? I have 50 seconds.
Sounds like there are no further questions. Thank you very much. The call is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.